This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We talk a lot about space on this program. We hear from scientists and astrophysicists and researchers, but not from the people who actually go up and do the work. Well, until now.
I think the most impressive thing about being in space is just the view.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear a conversation with Captain William Shepard, the first commander of the International Space Station, about working in space and the politics of working side by side with Russians. We'll also hear about school gardens, long-distance unicycle rides, and spend an academic minute playing with your food. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. For 159 days, William Shepard has been out of this world. That's how many days Captain Shepard spent in space, first as a mission specialist for three space shuttle flights, and then as the commander of Expedition 1, the first crew of the International Space Station. He was awarded the Congressional Space Medal of Honor in 2003, only the 13th person to receive that honor, and is a member of the International Space Hall of Fame. Captain William Shepard recently took part in the guest lecture series at the Institute for Human-Machine Cognition in Pensacola, Florida. He spoke with the Institute's communications manager, Carl Wernicke, about his experiences in space and working with the Russians.
Well, I think the most impressive thing about being in space is just the view. My first space flight was in 1988. It was a winter flight. We launched from Florida and went up basically up the East Coast and then over the Atlantic. The next couple orbits around the Earth, you could look out the back window, see the Rocky Mountains, and look out the front of the shuttle's window, and you could see from Cape Cod down to Florida. And taking in that much of the Earth in one instant was pretty shocking.
You commanded the first expedition to the space station, basically opened it up. What do you see as its future? What's the importance of the space station? I think people can see it orbiting overhead, but I don't think most Americans really understand what it's about.
I don't know what NASA made on the outside of the space station, but I think it's one of the biggest stealth programs that we've ever had because nobody knows it's even up there. I'm not meaning to be too humorous there. Space station was put together to be a premier research platform for six or seven major areas of activity for scientific and technical research, and it's well on its way to being productive to do that. I don't know that we'll see a host of Nobel Prizes coming off of work that the station had a part in doing, but I think that the most important thing about space station is this is a place not on the Earth. This is near the Earth, but not part of the Earth anymore. And we've got 3 to 6 astronauts and cosmonauts who live on this outpost on a semi-permanent basis. And so if you looked out in the night sky and you said, okay, fine, where is it that humans can be? Where is it that they can live and work? Is it just the Earth, or is it the Moon or Mars or some other place? Right now, nobody knows the answer to that question. But I do know that what we're doing on Space Station right now is a step in figuring out our place in the universe, and that's why it's so important.
Do you see the space station as a jumping-off place for other missions in the space, or is it a sort of a self-contained mission? I don't know. You spent 8 years working on this thing.
Well, the answer to that is probably both. It is self-contained in that it's a place that's your home 250 miles up in orbit, and you're pretty much on your own up there if something goes bad. You're limited in your resources, your water, your electricity, your oxygen, things like that. But it's also a place where we can look at answers to very fundamental questions. Like if we are going to go to Mars, we're going to be traveling for 6 to 9 months in a fairly hostile environment, a lot of radiation, weightless, unless we create some sort of artificial gravity by spinning the large vehicle. Nobody knows right now what the right protocols are to keep people healthy and functional on voyages of these durations. And space station is a key element in figuring out if this is technically and physically possible for us humans.
Of course, the growing tensions with Russia have highlighted some interesting facts or concerning facts. We buy our heavy lift rockets engines from the Russians. We have to essentially catch a ride on their craft to get up to the space station. Now, you've worked with the Russians for years. In fact, that first mission when you went up to the space station had Russians and it was on a Russian craft. Talk about that whole situation, what it was like talking with the Russians and how you see us working with them.
The kickoff to the space station program in its present form started in 1993. It was not too long after the Soviet Union broke up, and it's now, as it is, the Federation of Russian States. I think initially we were very apprehensive that we were going to get along, but I can tell you on the astronaut to cosmonaut level and the engineer to engineer level, the work has gone very, very well. We see eye to eye on a whole host of things because we both have the same sense of what's dangerous, what's important, and when you're working together as a crew, that's really what counts. Above that level in the senior management arena and the diplomatic and political arenas, it was very contentious. But things got done. We reached compromise, and the space station is in orbit today. It's been up there for 15 years now, and we arm wrestle each other once in a while across the table, but we got it done. I think the space station is in its present form has proven to be quite an effective engineering platform, and its performance has been far better than the designers probably could have hoped for. This leads me to believe that there's a lot of goodness in this cooperation, even if the political level between the U.S. and the Russians right now is, to say the least, frayed. We have learned a lot from each other about how to do this stuff that we do in space. I would hate to see us throw that cooperation away for some political imperative. I just think at least on the astronaut-cosmonaut level, we get along really well. We can do some great stuff. And the past 20 years that we've had working together is a testament to this. I just think it's something to consider in the broad scope of our relationship as nations.
That said, I presume you do agree that it's important that we have our own lift capacity. However, that certainly wouldn't preclude working with the Russians in the future, right?
Well, I think it's up to the two nations to figure out what they're going to do in the future, and I don't want to step into that sandbox right now. My job at NASA was to figure out how to make machines fly and have crews work together, and I think I enjoyed that. I'm going to leave the politics to somebody else. One of the most important things that I think happened while I was flying in space with my two Russian crewmates was we got on. Well, the station was very small, and we had a big part in building out the first large modules of station. And one of the things that came up was the U.S. laboratory called Destiny, and it has a very large observation window in the deck that you can look down and see the Earth. And a lot of our time after Destiny was on board was spent looking out the window and watching the Earth go by. And Yuri Gidzenko, who was a colonel in the Russian Air Force, would look out the window and point to spots around the Black Sea that he was stationed in his time as an Air Force pilot, and he would be on strip alert in his MiG-21 fighter ready for the Cold War. And I would show him places where I had trained and worked as a Navy SEAL, basically, again, waiting for the Cold War to start. And we realized in that moment that what we were doing was something way bigger than what our past lives had been involved with in this contest between East and West in the Cold War. We were on this international expedition, and all that stuff was really behind us. To me, that was really significant.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. As a former shuttle guy, someone who spent a lot of time in space, if you were offered a one-way trip to Mars, a one-way ticket, and it was the only way that you were ever going to get there, would you take it?
I would, but with the understanding that I would get on board with our crew and we would figure out a way to jury-rig the engines and the power supply so we could come back in one piece.
Captain William Shepard is a retired Navy SEAL and astronaut and served as the first commander of the International Space Station. He spoke with Carl Wernicke of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong.
More and more schools in the U.S. are starting school gardens, offering educators a chance to teach students about math and science through a hands-on experience. But as those involved can relate, growing fruits and veggies isn't child's play. Payne Roberts reports for Harvest Public Media on the challenges associated with sustaining a school garden.
In Lawrence, Kansas, asparagus is a hot commodity.
The demand for asparagus was and it continues to be very, very strong.
That's John Pendleton. Adorned in a matching green hat and apron, he's selling homegrown produce at the Clinton Parkway Nursery Farmers Market in Lawrence. Pendleton's Country Market is a staple at area farmers markets and has been selling locally grown food for more than 30 years.
Thanks for coming out today.
Several stands down, the competition. Three middle school students are selling potatoes, cucumbers, and an array of herbs that were all grown in their school garden. Perry Kennard, a seventh grade science teacher at Southwest Junior High in Lawrence, oversees this garden. It's their second summer in the market, but this year they tried something new, asparagus.
We're hoping to expand the variety that we can offer and the experience that we have for our kids and for our community.
So is there an asparagus war boiling in Kansas? Pendleton says no. The school gardens won't really harm his business, but he has felt an impact.
A particular restaurant might not be taking that much stuff, but if you take three or four restaurants and pool it together, then it makes it worthwhile to make a delivery. And if all of a sudden they're buying from the kids because it's the politically correct thing to do, you know, we maybe have lost a market that way.
Unexpected competition is one challenge communities must face when it comes to school gardens. The number of these projects in the U.S. has exploded in popularity over the past decade. That's according to the National Farm to School Network. These programs typically operate by student and volunteer labor with funding from donations and grants. Most often, the produce is used in school cafeterias, but because the growing season doesn't coincide with the school year, the question of how to most effectively use school gardens in the summertime is often a concern. Here's Pendleton again.
They start off with saying, yeah, we can run it through the school kitchens and things like that, but when you realize that the majority of the produce that they raise isn't during the school year.
To curb the amount of produce sold at the farmers market, Southwest Junior High offers a CSA program for parents and faculty, and it donates some food to the school cafeteria. However, because the growing season peaks during the summertime, less than 10% of that food is served at the school. Summertime also causes difficulty when it comes to enlisting labor assistance, leaving the work to volunteers and teachers.
One of the advantages of being a teacher is that you have your summers off. Well, I don't have my summers off anymore.
And that burden isn't reduced once the school year returns, as teachers then must cultivate their gardens and their students.
Listen, it's very easy to get into this well-intended but not understand the amount of labor involved.
That's Stephen Ritz, a teacher and administrator from the South Bronx who advocates nationwide for school gardens. He recently came to Lawrence to offer advice for community members who are interested in sustaining its school gardens. Ritz said school gardens are more successful today because educators tie them to academics, as compared to the traditional model, where gardens were used as an excuse to move classes outdoors in pleasant weather.
Now we're talking about percent germination. We're talking about reading. We're talking about writing. We're talking about documenting the process. We're talking about math. We're talking about making connections. We're talking about the whole process, as opposed to just being out there and digging in the dirt.
The National Farm to School Network expects the number of school gardens to increase. For now, there appears to be plenty of room for them at farmers markets, as the market for locally grown food increases. But as any gardener can attest, overcrowding can stunt growth. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Payne Roberts.
Still to come, a family of homeschooled students in Maine keeps things unique. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1231. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In the summer of 2011, 20-year-old Bob Mueller rode his unicycle across the United States. Bob and his six siblings were raised in a self-schooling household where each child determined what to learn based on their interests. Molly Jean Bennett from the SALT Radio Institute has the story of an extraordinary Maine family and the adventures that self-schooling has taken them on.
Last May, residents of St. Albans, Vermont, turned on their TVs to this.
A young man from Waterville, Maine, is on an ambitious trip. He's riding across the country to raise money for a good cause.
But it's what he's riding that's getting all the attention. Judy Simpson has his...
I'm Bob Mueller. I'm 20 years old. I'm a unicycler.
This summer, Bob rode his unicycle from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon to raise money for the Red Cross.
It was about 3,500 miles and it was 84 days.
Bob was accompanied by his younger sister, Laura, who rode next to him on a bicycle, and his older sister, Anna, who drove a support van. Riding a unicycle all day is more uncomfortable than riding a bike, Bob says. First, his knees would start to hurt. Then his back. Then pretty much everything else. You can't coast on a unicycle, so you have to pedal even when you go downhill. And when Bob finally finished, it was surreal.
Just got off and walked onto the beach, and I mean, it had been like 85 days where all you do is you get up and you ride, and it was really weird not, you know, having anything left to ride and just done.
Bob has been home for almost 2 months now, living at home with his parents and siblings and trying to process the epic journey he's just finished. He works in his dad's insurance adjuster office and buses tables at a nearby restaurant. He shows me the garage where he keeps his unicycle. The entire ceiling of the Mueller's two-car garage is hung with unicycles and bicycles. Spoked wheels of all sizes almost entirely obscure the rafters.
Well, actually, here's the one I learned on, which is the 20-inch kind of starter uni, and I gave it to my brother. He learned to ride a unicycle before he could bike, which I was quite proud of.
Wow. Did you teach him?
I did. Well, everybody kind of did. Everybody in my house rides except for my older sister.
Bob has three brothers and three sisters. So where does this family of unicyclers come from? Bob and all of his siblings were homeschooled in a somewhat unusual way. Bob's mom, Karen, has a particular approach to educating her children.
Say yes whenever possible.
Karen is really focused on self-schooling, and she's said yes to all sorts of projects over the years. From a very young age, the Mueller kids were encouraged to find out what interested them most and essentially pitch their own school projects to Karen. Whether those projects were caring for reptiles or learning to fix a unicycle, Karen has always been a big proponent of learning by doing. And another major part of schooling in the Mueller home was a family bluegrass band. The Mueller children all learned instruments when they were small. Karen decided it would be a good idea for her introverted children to practice playing in public. So about 10 years ago, the family began playing in nursing homes, and the venues just got larger and larger.
Most of you know that we have not just the Muellers you see, but a few more, so I'm going to bring one out.
That's Karen introducing the youngest Mueller, George, at a concert the family played 3 years ago.
I will preface this song by saying, in our house, we love bluegrass so much, it's okay for a five-year-old to sing a prison song.
For Bob, the kind of independent learning he did as a kid has continued into a young adulthood. Bob isn't going to college, not now. At a time when the cost of higher education is rising and the prospects of finding a job afterwards are grim, Bob is choosing to focus on his own adventures. Back in the house, Bob and Karen show me a huge map on the wall above the dining room table.
If you peel this one up, you can see...
The map shows the entire Western Hemisphere. Someone has drawn a thick black line from the northern corner of Alaska down to the tip of South America in a felt-tip marker. Bob hopes it's his next unicycle trip. Another Mueller adventure. Right now, 18-year-old Laura Mueller is farming in New Zealand, and 26-year-old Tom Mueller is pursuing a PhD in pipe organ. You see, all those years touring around in a van together create a sort of zany sibling rivalry.
The word epic gets used a lot at our house, and it's usually followed by the word achievement.
We kind of joke with each other, you know, to see who can do the craziest thing. And last year, my brother played all of Bach's organ works in 1 year, which is a tremendous amount of music to learn and play. And, you know, I told him I was going to unicycle across America. He's like, yeah, go do that. And so I called him after the trip and was like, look at what I've done now. And I don't know, it's just kind of a running, see who can do the craziest thing and keep it going.
Do you think you're winning?
Currently, yes. Yes, I would.
For Salt Radio, I'm Molly Jean Bennett.
I want to ride it where I like.
99.9% of parents have probably said the following sentence. Don't play with your food. Well, it seems you're all wrong. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. If you've ever cared for toddlers, you know how messy they can be when they eat. And as Larissa Samuelson, associate professor of psychology at the University of Iowa, reveals, the mess is a crucial component of the learning process.
Don't play with your food is a familiar refrain at the dinner table with young children. Recent research in my laboratory, however, shows how playing, sometimes even with food, is critical for learning. Imagine you are looking at a cup of school glue and a cup of milk. How do you know which one you should drink? Visual information alone won't tell you, but if you stuck your finger in the cups, you'd quickly know. This is the situation faced by children when learning names for non-solid things like pudding and oatmeal. In my previous work, we found that children had trouble learning names for non-solid substances in the laboratory, even though they learned names for similar things at home. It turns out, however, most of the names for non-solid substances that children learn early are names for foods, words like milk, juice, and jelly. And critically, young children experience foods in a particular context, the high chair. This context is special, both because it is different from the typical table setting we use in the laboratory, and because many children are used to playing with their food and getting messy when seated in their high chair. To look at how playing might make learning easier, we taught toddlers names for unfamiliar substances while seated either at a table or in a high chair. We showed them a novel substance, blue mayonnaise in a figure eight, and named it, "This is my toma." We then showed them pink mayonnaise in a squiggle and mustard in a figure eight, and asked them which was also a toma. Children whose parents reported they were messy eaters at home played with the stimuli when they were seated in the high chair, but not at the table. And those children who played with the stimuli learned the names better. They picked the pink mayonnaise squiggle when asked to get the toma. The high chair context brought out behaviors essential to learning names for non-solid substances. This shows that context can help children use what they already know to learn new things, and it also illustrates a more general truth. Knowledge is constructed over time via play.
That was Larissa Samuelson of the University of Iowa.
You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.